The 2006 Sunstone Symposium Arizona presents Session 4, When Cultures Collide, Mormonism in Context of Ongoing Discussions of Colonialism, Conversion, and Globalized Religion. A panel discussion with Charles Randall Paul, Megan Fallater, and Kenneth Morrison.
Good morning. My name is Randall Paul. I am the moderator of this panel today. We'll have a short paper read by Megan in a minute. We'll each introduce ourselves and give our interest in this topic, and we'll respond to Megan's paper and then have a general discussion. For those of you who want to know, the topic roughly is a topic that is very germane to in this world of shrinking communication, and it has to do with the issue of proselytizing, attempted conversion, and the not only the process of doing that, but the appropriateness of doing that. To frame the context, I did my dissertation at the University of Chicago at the Committee on Social Thought, and my topic was an early 20th century conflict between Mormons and Protestants in Utah and how they engaged that conflict nonviolently. The interest in that topic was significant from a poll on one side of scholars saying any form of proselytizing is equivalent to cultural genocide. As we learned in the last session, choice of terms are loaded in religious studies, and cultural genocide clearly indicates that author's opinion of proselytizing. On the other hand, those who are engaged in proselytizing in the conversion process see it as a win-win program. That is to say, when it's successful, both sides of the equation are extremely happy. They've found the truth. They've left an old life. They wouldn't like anything more than to have had that experience. And so we have these two poles that are out there that are politically extremely charged today in the world, coming out of the 19th century colonial world. We still have this notion of power that is being spread by various means throughout the world and not allowing indigenous populations to be themselves. My focus of interest today will be inevitable contamination of social experience, that the human is interrelated. There's no such thing truly as an individual. I like René Girard's term, we're all interdividuals. And so we all contaminate each other from the very moment of birth to the last breath we take. And the question for me is, who do you choose to contaminate you? How much contamination do you allow? And it's very interesting to me, being a Jamesian scholar, this notion of selection. We are all in it. We can't avoid influencing each other. Life is basically a matter of persuasion, though we try to say we're not persuading. We're just here to understand. The fact is, I'll be keenly interested in what the other panelists have to say on that topic. So that's my my shtick. I will pass it now to Ken. Would you introduce yourself, please,
sure,
and tell us what your interests are today?
I'm Ken Morrison. I'm a professor in religious studies here at ASU. I am trained as a historian and have made my career accidentally. I mean, I didn't know it was going to turn out this way. Focusing on Native American religious history initially, but then the study of Native American religions in particular. Within that field, I have done a number of historical studies, ethno-historical studies, combining anthropology and history, looking at 17th century French missions to Algonquian and Iroquoian peoples in the Canadian-American Northeast. Out of that, I've developed a number of concerns that I am on the verge of exploring in other places and in other ways, but central among them would be the idea that we really don't understand missionization because we don't understand Native American cultures. And I know that because I know where I began, and I know the assumptions that I had, and I know how difficult it has been for me in conversations with historians and anthropologists to identify those assumptions and how it doesn't work. I mean, now when you know that Native American religions are non-theistic to begin with, then that raises whole questions about what religious change means in terms of a movement from one kind of worldview to another. And then when you realize that Native American religions are non-dogmatic, I mean, there are no things that you have to believe to be a religious Navajo person. Nothing at all. So then when you understand that because the situation is fluid in the way that Native Americans assume things about the nature of being and the ways in which they know rather than believe, then you have to come up with the point of view the Native American people, and I think other indigenous peoples, are religious pragmatists. They're interested in how the world works and what's going on, and they respond to that. Such a recognition of power in the Christian tradition on the part of indigenous peoples doesn't constitute, to my mind, a conversion, except in the Pauline sense that missionization provided Native Americans a context to think about, to move from a pre-theoretical position about religion to a more theoretical one, and in the process to rediscover and re-own and reapply the essential truths of their own traditional worldviews. Generally speaking, that's where I'm coming from.
Now I'll have a paper. I come to work to present something today, so we very, if you wouldn't mind, Megan, do your basic interests, scholarly interests, and how you came to the topic.
Okay. My name is Megan Falater, and I was an undergraduate student at ASU. I just graduated last month. I was raised Mormon, and a few years after I stopped practicing, I ran across some information about the Indian Student Placement Program, which had surprised me because I was raised in the church, but I had never heard of this program. And can everyone hear me? Yeah, okay. I never heard of the program, and I hadn't even heard anyone ever talk about taking indigenous students and raising them in white homes. And so I just wanted to read more about it, and I eventually just started writing about it in most of my classes. So I hope to apply to grad school next fall and perhaps continue to study this in the future. But my paper is called Identities of Indigenous Participants in the Indian Student Placement Program. In the middle of the 20th century, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormon Church, joined the numerous Christian religions working with and proselytizing to indigenous peoples in the United States. The Indian Student Placement Program was the religious institution's first coordinated effort to reach indigenous youth. The program removed indigenous students from United States reservations and Canadian reserves and placed them with off-reservation families, who were usually white, from 1954 to 1992, though some students were placed with Mormon families as early as 1947. Approximately 50,000 students participated in the program during these years. Indigenous school-aged children were removed from their homes and reservations with parental consent and placed with Mormon families who housed them for the school year. The program was a voluntary foster parenting system that provided indigenous youth with educational and economic advantages not available to them on reservations. Mormon leaders also formed the placement program, however, to influence the beliefs and identities of these youth. These leaders expected students to conceptualize their identities and even their bodies in prescribed ways. While this was the first program of its kind created by the Mormon Church, the Indian Student Placement Program was by no means the first effort made by a religious institution headed by whites to educate indigenous children. The United States federal government and other Christian religious groups have sought to educate and assimilate indigenous peoples through schooling since the 19th century. These schools influenced the ways that indigenous children could perform their racial and tribal identities. Historian Robert Trenert Jr. noted that students at the Phoenix Indian School, an off-reservation boarding school founded in 1891, underwent a process of quote-unquote de-Indianization, shortly after their first arrival. School officials forced children to change their hair and clothing to create the appearance of outward assimilation to the mainstream culture of the United States. Further, the Phoenix Indian School received children from multiple tribes and nations, so children were separated from friends and fellow tribesmen to make it more difficult to speak their native tongue. Many of these schools attempted to influence indigenous youth by isolating them from their communities and punishing them when they did try to use their indigenous languages. These students' identities and even their bodies became sites of control at boarding schools. The Mormon Church did not participate in these educational efforts, but the Indian Student Placement Program inherited the legacy of these schools, goals, and methods. To some extent, the aims of the placement program are similar to those of earlier schools. Both encouraged specific religious indoctrination, and both sought to determine the identities of indigenous peoples. While the program did not accept non-Mormon students, some leaders feared that the program would nonetheless harm indigenous communities. Goldie Denny, the Director of Social Services for the Quinault Nation and Child Welfare Committee Chairperson in 1978 for the National Congress of American Indians, worried that their community's children would lose their indigenous identities through the placement program. John Stewart and Peter Wiley, two critics of Mormonism, infamously described the program as cultural genocide and a form of kidnapping. In reality, the program was more voluntary than these critics suggest. Some of the students who participated in the placement program were Mormon long before they began their placement, and some belonged to families who were Mormon for generations. They likely didn't consider a program created by their own religion to be an example of kidnapping. Other parents were unfamiliar with the Mormon Church or its doctrine when they agreed to send their children to the placement program. George P. Lee's parents, for example, knew little about Mormonism and allowed their son to enter the program during its first year on the strength of the testimonies delivered by two missionaries. Not all parents, then, chose the program because of their knowledge of the Mormon Church. These parents consented to the placement program because they distrusted the other educational and economic options offered to them. While many indigenous parents sought greater control over their children's educations by creating schools such as Rough Rock Demonstration School on the Navajo Reservation and gaining positions on school boards, not all parents chose this route. Some hoped that the placement program would provide better opportunities to their children than did boarding schools and day schools. Ronald Senior, a Navajo Mormon who attended the Tuba Sitting Boarding School prior to placement, likened his experiences at the boarding school to a, quote, prison environment or boot camp, end quote. He explained that both he and his mother believed that the placement program would provide him with better educational and environmental opportunities. In addition, Ione Yellow John, a Shoshone woman who was raised Mormon, first entered the placement program when her mother was unable to care for her or the other children in her family. In this instance, the placement program provided a Mormon parent with economic assistance by housing and caring for children during the school year. Anthropologist Martin Topper noted that the Navajo parents he met considered the placement program the, quote, least immediately painful solution, end quote, available to care for and educate their children. The decision that many Navajo parents made in the 1970s to put children in the placement program, according to Topper, was one of economic necessity. Parents chose to send their children to the placement program for varied reasons. The placement program imposed prescribed identities on its students. Mormon doctrine identifies indigenous descendants of the Lamanites, a usually wicked population depicted in the Book of Mormon. White Mormons referred to these students as Lamanites in literature about the program without regard for whether these individual students identified themselves as such. Spencer W. Kimball, a strong advocate of the placement program and the president and prophet of the Mormon Church from 1973 to his death in 1985, described indigenous peoples as Lamanites. Speaking at a Lamanite youth conference in 1971 about Peter McDonald, who was then the chairman of the Navajo Tribal Council, Kimball said, quote, "It pleased me to hear Mr. McDonald say he was a Lamanite. We knew it all the time, but we didn't know that he did." End quote. Kimball believed that he and other white Mormons who shared his belief understand the identities of indigenous peoples better than the indigenous peoples understand their own identities. Further, Kimball argued that these students' Mormon religious identities should be more important than their racial identities or tribal affiliations. Kimball argued in 1965, quote, "They are not Indians first, they are Latter-day Saints. I am not English first, though my family came from England. I am a Latter-day Saint first," end quote. Kimball, a white Mormon who believed that his religious identity was more important than his racial identity, demanded that other Mormons follow his lead. In particular, he expected indigenous Mormons to model their identities after his own. Excuse me. All people are different. Some indigenous Mormons did identify themselves in ways that met Kimball's expectations. George P. Lee explained shortly after his appointment to the Quorum of the Seventy in 1975, quote, "I am proud to be a child of the Book of Mormon people. I have found my true heritage. I have found my true identity," end quote. Lee identified himself in accordance with Mormon doctrine. Ray Baldwin Lewis, another Navajo Mormon, similarly asserted his status as a Lamanite and argued that the placement program is an important component of the, quote, destiny of the Lamanite people, end quote. Milton E. Watts, a Catawba Mormon, wrote, quote, "My earthly heritage as a Catawba is profoundly important to me. It is equally important to know that I have an eternal identity as well. The eternal identity began long before my Catawba earthly identity. My eternal identity tells me who I was before I was Catawba and what I may be after this life," end quote. These men argued that Mormon doctrine helped them better understand and prioritize their racial identities. Other students did not heed Kimball's demands and expressed frustration with the program. An unknown number of students left the program early or didn't return to their placement families after their first years of placement. Students who rebelled by refusing to follow the regulations of the Mormon Church were sent home or were denied subsequent years of placement. Consequently, some students strategically chose disobedience in order to end their placements and return to their natal families early. Several students believe that this disobedience proved their loyalty to their indigenous communities. In his study of Navajo youth in the placement program, Topper noted in 1979, quote, "Being a Jack Mormon is being a traditional Navajo," end quote. The male youth who chose to be Jack Mormons, or baptized Mormons who don't practice the religion, define their tribal identities in opposition to their experiences on placement. Their disobedience to Mormon expectations provided them an opportunity to assert their identities as indigenous people. Topper also noted that female Navajo youth who returned to their natal families after spending the school year in the placement program engaged in, quote-unquote, hysteria, which he described as times in which the women were agitated, hyperventilating, and often hallucinating. He attributed this behavior to, quote-unquote, major identity changes that the women faced in shifting amongst different communities and families. These students clearly struggled with their experiences and the expectations placed upon them. Other students, in contrast, continued with the placement program but came to lose their connections with their natal cultures and communities. Maple Yazzie, a Navajo woman, explained, quote, Placement has made me lose touch with my Navajo culture. I respect it, but I don't really feel it's mine," end quote. Similarly, John Benally, a Navajo man, noted, quote, "I am successful, but I'll never be white, yet I don't have a sense of being Navajo. The sense of loss won't destroy me, and I will do well within white man's society, but I can never go back and live on the reservation. The only thing I know about Indians I learned from books," end quote. Students on the placement program spent the entire academic year, including winter vacation, with their off-reservation families and only lived with their natal families during the summer. They had limited contact with other placement students in many instances as well. Siblings, extended family, and friends were separated from one another because many placement families were only willing to accept one student. Anthropologist Tona Hanjin noted in her research on the program that those students who could speak indigenous languages often did not live near anyone else who shared that language. Kay Cox, a white Mormon who housed several placement students, reported that a fellow foster mother forbade her foster child to speak Apache. Several students in the Mormon Church's program, as a result, forgot their languages because they could not practice them during repeated nine-month placements. It is not surprising, then, that any of these students might feel alienated from their racial identities or tribal affiliations. They spent little of their childhoods with their families or with their on-reservation communities. Neither were they exposed to urban indigenous populations. Students in the placement program were in many ways physically isolated from other indigenous peoples. Prescribed identities also focused on the bodies of indigenous students. George P. Lee remembered that a well-meaning white Mormon cut his hair on the first day of placement. This man and others cut students' hair without acknowledging the importance and significance the hair holds for some indigenous nations. Other students lost their hair because the white families assigned to them did not understand how to style hair with different hair own. Ione Yellowjohn, who believed that her foster mother was, quote, prejudiced against her, end quote, explained that her foster mother did not know how to style her hair. Rather than learn how to handle hair different from her own, the foster mother cut the student's hair so short that it, in Yellowjohn's words, resembled a boy's hair. These forced changes to her hair distressed her. Lee's and Yellowjohn's experiences resembled those of indigenous students in boarding schools, where students' physical identities were controlled in an effort to make them assimilate. Mormon doctrine also addresses skin color, though the particularities of what differences in skin color connote changed during the program's lifetime. The Book of Mormon notes that the one component of the Lamanites' curse was their darker skins, which will make them, quote-unquote, loathsome to the Nephites, or the white, usually righteous people depicted in the Book of Mormon. Some placement participants expressed discomfort and shame with their skin color and the physical differences between them and their placement families. Kay Cox noted that her 13-year-old Apache daughter bathed with Clorox bleach in an effort to lighten her skin. This doctrine influenced the ways that placement students understood their identities and physical bodies. Mormon beliefs about racial differences and curses negatively impacted these students. Another Mormon belief that was popular during the existence of the placement program concerned changing skin color. Many Mormons believed that the darker skin color of indigenous students would lighten as they became Mormon. Editions of the Book of Mormon published during the first decades of the program included a passage in 2 Nephi, chapter 30, verse 6, indicating that as the descendants of the Lamanites became righteous, they would also become, quote, white and delightsome, end quote. While this phrase is controversial and was not included in all editions of the text in the 19th century and is not included in the present edition, it was accepted as true through many of the years of the Indian student placement program. Kimball even claimed that he had witnessed this whitening. He said at the church's semi-annual general conference in October 1960, quote, the day of the Lamanites is nigh. For years they have been growing delightsome. Now they are becoming white and delightsome as they were promised. In this picture, which I don't have, unfortunately, of the 20 Lamanite missionaries, 15 of the 20 were as light as Anglos. Five were darker, but equally delightsome. The children of the home placement program in Utah are often lighter than their brothers and sisters in the Hogans on the reservation. These young members of the church are changing to whiteness and to delightsomeness. One white elder jokingly said that he and his companion were donating blood regularly to the hospital in the hope that the process might be accelerated. End quote. It is possible that the students Kimball described actually had light skin or skin lighter than other members of their families. Siblings from a single family do not always share the same skin tone. Further, George P. Lee observed that he lost the tan he developed on his reservations when he spent so much time indoors during placement. It seems that Kimball ignored these possibilities in his effort to find proof that supported the doctrine that skin color reflects an individual's righteousness. The very bodies of indigenous students were sites of interest and control for Mormon leaders. The placement program did provide advantages to some students. It offered them better schools and provided them with brief opportunities to live with families who possessed more economic resources than were available on reservations. But the program and the beliefs of many white Mormons involved in the program were also harmful. Religious leaders wished to assimilate these students into Mormon culture. In this regard, they were not very different from non-Mormon Christians and government leaders who sought to control and define the cultures of indigenous peoples. Church leaders sought to control these students' identities. It was not enough that indigenous children practiced Mormonism. Leaders also expected them to conceptualize themselves, their bodies, their communities, and the world in the same ways that white Mormons do. While the program is no longer in existence, its legacy still remains in the identities and religious beliefs of its participants. Thank you.
I think what we'd like to do right now is honor Megan by thanking her for her paper and address her paper specifically for a few minutes before we expand the discussion more broadly. So, Ken, first of all, this paper was quite down your alley in terms of the things you've studied, and so I'd be very interested in having your response to the paper, and then we'll open it to the audience.
Well, I'm very, very interested in the paper, and I hadn't read it before, so it was really, really fun to hear. I earlier took a position that Native Americans do not convert, and Megan requires me to readjust. I mean, I was making that statement out of the 17th century and the missionary situation there. The situation that you're talking about is distinctive of the American policy of, quote, civilization, assimilation, and Christianization, those things going along. And in a very distinctive way, there was some success from a non-Indian point of view because individuals were extracted from their community and denied the use of their language. I mean, if you think about it in the first place, the people that Megan is talking about are young individuals. They are individuals who are not fully linguistically competent to begin with, and they're also not culturally competent. And at that level, I personally do not think that the term genocide is too strong a term to describe the intent and to some extent the effect of that policy. Otherwise, I'd really want to temper those terms and to try to see what's going on as an interhuman. I am an intersubjectivist like you, Randy, so that's a good thing to know. But what's astounding, given these kinds of programs, and this isn't an isolated Mormon program, but is in fact an artifact of U.S. federal policy, is that tribalism as a principle and community as a way of life has survived for Native American people. And it's one of the great paradoxes that that Native American people have been able to survive as communities despite this kind of extraction of individuals. And that's the thing that I think that we really need to think about and reflect on, partly because, of course, at the present time, more than 50% of Native American people do not live on reservations any longer. And yet there still is, to some very significant degree, the preservation of a tribal identity, a return home to the reservation for ceremonies, to visit grandparents and aunts and uncles, and that sort of thing. The situation is even further complicated when you realize that Native Americans have a very large, a very high rate of population growth, which means that the largest percentage of Native American people at present are young people, people under the age of 25. And again, that whole question of cultural competence is a real complication, which is to say that I really like the particular situation that Megan has brought to our attention, and I think that I also want to reflect on the fact that this is not a historical thing. It's not a process that is over and done with, but rather is an example of any number of situations that has been offended by culturally tribalism as a principle, and tribalism has astoundingly survived anyway as a social and a religious principle. So thank you, Megan.
And I would like to make a couple of comments before we open it to questions, too. I was interested in the identity question that you brought up, and the issue of what are you first? Antonio Gramsci, who you might know, was a social theorist and a communist and in jail at the time in Italy, wrote some wonderful things. And he admired Catholicism. Because he said the communists will only be successful when they learn from the Roman Catholics how to be truly cross-cultural and how to get people to do things out of their own individual heartfelt desire, not to put force of a system on them. He said the Catholics have got the of course, don't believe their religion, but they've got the right idea here. And if the communists can get that, then we will take over the world, you know. And this idea of being, he called them blocks, but something that's beyond nationalism, beyond tribalism, that could be somehow adopted truly worldwide and made your primary identity is an interesting question. I'm fascinated with the fact that this one case where, what am I? Am I an Indian? You know, it's a, what is it? Neil Diamond, you know, New York ain't home, or New York's home, but I'm in L.A., you know, that idea is very much a problem that all human beings deal with in a pluralistic world, and so I'm interested in the question of how people rank their identity, what they put first. What is the prime differentiation? Human? Then perhaps is it gender? Perhaps is it family, son, daughter? You know, it's interesting. Or do we, as the church leader of the Mormons said, no, all those should be trumped by I'm a Latter-day Saint, you know? So it's an interesting idea and a powerful one. So the other thing that I'd like to discuss is the problem that Lee Yearly talks about. Lee is the head of the religion department at Stanford. And he studied Buddhism for many years in Korea, and he tells the story of when he finally left to come home to the States. He pulled out of a harbor, he's in a boat, and he just visited a Buddhist shrine, and he was watching it was a cloudy day, and as the shore pulled away from him, so to speak, and it went into the mist, he had this pang in his heart. He realized that he wanted to be a Buddhist. and that he was leaving this and going home to his Christian, academic, American background and family. And as he was dealing with that pang, he also realized, but if I'm a Buddhist, I can't be a Christian. I can't have the same affiliation and sincerity and belief that I have with my family. And so that formed his view of the world in a very specific way from that point forward. And he since has come up with a new need for a world virtue. He calls it the virtue of spiritual regret. If you're philosophically inclined, it might be the virtue of realizing you want to be someone else, but you have to be who you are. And you can change who you are, but in that change, you will be leaving that other person that you weren't, or that you're no longer. And of course, he's putting the hierarchy when he talks about spiritual regret and the world-ordering notion of being a religious person or having a worldview. To have one worldview is to, in a sense, reject another worldview that you really would love to experience fully, deeply, to be that other person. And so I find that in your paper there is room, perhaps, for this possibility of being a Navajo and yet being an American Navajo, and to appreciate Christianity and yet not to have it, instead of having the colonial antagonism, have this appreciative virtue of regret that you just can't, I have to be your opponent, sorry, because I'd like to be on that side of the table too. So there's a certain virtue there I think we can all think about in the world today. Open to questions now. Yes?
Megan, I'd like to ask a question. You were talking about the Indian Placement Program, and it was terminated in 1992.
Yeah.
Do you have any information as to why it was terminated? A change in policy?
Well, I'm not aware of any official explanation for why it stopped, but it started being phased out in the late 1980s, so that the only students who were still in the program were the ones who had started when they were young and just needed to finish through high school. I've read speculation that the reason it was canceled was because Kimball had died in 1985, and he was one of the main supporters of the program, so when he wasn't there to support it anymore, the program just kind of died out.
But it's also part of a major shift nationally. I mean, somewhere in there, I'm not sure of the year, but the Indian Child Protection Act was passed because there was an increasing recognition, of course, that the young people are an essential component of tribal health and survival. And that's what that act has been about.
Are you talking about the 78 law?
Is it 78?
I think so.
Okay.
I think the Mormons worked pretty hard to make sure they were legal within that.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I was kind of alluding to it, in terms of the Child Welfare Act, where a Native American member is really a tribal member, so the tribe serves parental authority as to the, let's say, placement or adoption of the child, as to the tribal court system. And even though the individual Native American parent makes the decision, it still has to go through But so it's more of a Kimball and the Native American the Tribal Act. So it's more pragmatic.
We had an Indian placement student in my home when I was a young man, my wife and I have something to say about that. But before I do,
well, I was going to say the Red Power Movement had a huge effect on it.
When it gets to the football games where Stanford won't play BYU because of the Indian Placement Program, it's serious. And of course, Stanford had to change the name of its mascot, too, to come into line with the whole psychology that was going on in the country at that time. Before I make my comment, I'll guess in the back.
I think the question that you brought up about identity and kind of arguing against the notion that we have a single identity, or that maybe, or that that we can't sort of be many identities. And I mean, I feel that we can be. And I just want to say I agree with that. I think. For example, I'm married to a man who was married before and has three children, and we've been married now for about 6.5 years, and I've seen his children kind of make the shift from being in the one family that was intact to being members of two families now, their mom's family and our family. And at first, it was, I think it was a difficult adjustment, obviously, it would be. But as they've made the adjustment and come to see themselves as part of those families, I was really insecure at first. I just thought, how are they ever going to learn to love me? I've just come into a situation, they don't know me. And yet they've accepted me, and I feel like we have a good relationship. And they've just accepted now that they belong to two families. And both families love them, and they're a part of them. I think that we're called up in this society, in modern society, especially when there's so many different political, cultural influences upon us, educational influences, that we can be kind of different. I think we can embrace different identities at different times. Because I just don't feel like we have to be, like for example, new kids, new situations. Megan, I don't know if you interviewed, I think clearly you've talked to some students, but I'm just wondering if some of them felt that their Navajo-ness and their Mormon-ness or whatever enhanced each other, or that they could be both at one time and appreciate things about both things, or if they could appreciate the opportunities that they had, even though that may have meant that they were losing something. Richard Rodriguez was a scholar, and he talks about how when he grew up in a working class migrant community, when he grew up, got a PhD, taught at Berkeley, I'm not sure where he was at, but he realized he couldn't ever really go back. But I don't think, and he mourned that, as you mentioned, but I don't think he was ever saying that what he gained was really, really horrible, and that that exchange, that transaction, ended up being a bad thing for him. And so I was just wondering if you met students or talked to people in the program that felt that overall, it may have been, may not have been the best situation for them. Their parents maybe had to put them in the situation because of economic situations, but they came out of it thinking, well, I gained something. Okay.
Well, I did interview some people, and I'm also working from interviews that BYU conducted in the early 1990s on some students. And it seemed that, there really was a range. There are some people who loved the program, who benefited from it a lot, and there are some students who hated it and actually didn't want to talk to me at all about the program other than to confirm that they were actually in it. I think you can expect that from any kind of a program, but there are things that can be gained from being in two different cultures or two different families, but there are also ways when you're forced to be in that and you didn't really choose it that, even if you are gaining something from it, it's not necessarily the best situation that you could have been in.
Well, I'm not saying this program was right or I'm not wrong. Clearly, there's some major philosophical and fundamental problems with it. I'm just, kind of wondering, how did the people that were in it themselves perceive their life changed and it was for the better or for the worse when they came out
of it? Well, again, this depends on, which students we're talking about.
Yeah, they were talking
about. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Any other comments? Yes.
Did it for the church build a program of success?
I believe so. The Mormon Church isn't really known for saying that something they did was a failure.
But I just wanted to ask a comment. Some of your research maybe has gotten into that.
The Mormon prophets, particularly Kimball, were very proud of the program, and they would point to people such as George P. Lee, who joined the program during its first year, and he was in it throughout the 1950s and 1960s, and later became one of the general authorities of the Mormon Church. And, I mean, he is a poster child for the program. He became very successful and was a general authority for a while. And you, from the materials that I've seen, the Mormon Church would talk about George P. Lee rather than the students who chose to leave the program because they didn't like it.
Go ahead.
In Tucson, they made a real effort to get the Indian students together on a biweekly basis, or families, you know, if they had a sibling in the community, and so they addressed that need somewhat. I've been on the reservation several times visiting a friend up there. Of course, the active church members there, a lot of them came from that program, but I wondered how many of them remained active in the church as a result of the program. Do you have any data on that?
I don't think the church has kept any data on that. Most of the people that they did interview in the early 1990s for their oral history program were Mormons who did participate in the program and were still active in the church. So, I mean, there are many indigenous Mormons who were in the program and did remain with the church, but there's no way to know who decided not to be Mormon afterwards. I don't know how you could track them down.
I can respond anecdotally and with some authority. We had a child that stayed with us. She came to us when she was, I think, 13, and stayed 2 years. We were living in Salt Lake City at the time. Parents who were involved in the program would meet from time to time and talk with each other about issues. And one of my personal beliefs on this is the reason the program ended was the parents involved in the program saw these issues so graphically and could no longer hold to just one view, meaning that it was great for the kid and great for the family because they were in a better economic situation, having a better education, and theoretically maybe getting a little bit better Mormonism, though that wasn't usually the case because Mormonism was taught on the reservation too. So the real program here was better education, giving them an affirmative action programming. That's what the parents involved in the program were saying to themselves. But then they would go back and visit every once in a while on the reservation, and they'd see the mirror image. These parents want to have their children with them, and they'd feel the tug of this impossible problem of taking the child out of the home for economic and social benefits, and yet ripping the family apart. And that was so much part of the ambivalence of the parents participating in the program that I think it was a grassroots thing as well as whatever happened top down that ended up that just and in modern society, these other issues we've talked about here today and why in the broader community, the idea that the indigenous people ought to be honored and not the evolutionary theory that we've made so much progress, let's get them going. I think we have a critique of science, we have a critique of American culture and Westernism generally, and all that thing kind of started to trickle down, and the program's gone. And it wasn't just the American Mormon program, but I think all over the world this issue is one that's to this very day problematic. Do you send your kids away to boarding school? You know, do you send them to the continent to get educated or uneducated? Those hold issues there are today. What do you do to the family? Yes, sir.
Industrial school, the youth correctional program in Ogden in the late 50s and 60s. And we had a number of Native American, mostly Navajo students that were incarcerated, adjudicated for delinquent offenses. And I had an opportunity to interview a number of these kids. And now this was just a small population, but that there was a common narrative in terms of the kids that were in the placement program that they had a fairly good adjustment up into junior high. And then when dating started to occur, and then the cliques, you know, the high school, junior high cliques began to form, they were alienated and began to feel a tremendous ambivalence
in terms of and rejection, and also from the parents in terms of the dating. And when the kids would go back to the reservation, they would take all of the clothes or stuff that the middle-class Mormon families gave them. And when the kids would go to the reservation, obviously they it was dispersed throughout the extended family of the clan. So they'd come back with absolutely nothing. And that would put the parents in a rage, trying to kind of like, you know, those gifts were your gifts. But that conflict at that adolescent junior high level produced a tremendous strain on these kids. And of course, our program, our policy was to get them out of Utah, out of the industrial school, and get them back on the reservation, where the problems obviously lessened. But that was just a narrow population, and I walked away from that with a tremendously negative feeling about the Indian placement program.
Would you like?
We have a viable social structure really comes home, because suddenly the communication stops. And your notion of yearning, I mean, I have a niece who is about ready to spend a year in Italy, and the whole family is very exciting for the, you know, the cultural perspective that she will achieve. One of the things that I would say in terms of this problem of adolescence as a complication is that, yes, this is a very difficult period for Native American students. There are studies of the Hopi that show how the Hopi young go through a process of, you know, self-destruction and, you know, an attraction to the larger Anglo culture. And then somewhere around the age of 38, something happens, and they become traditional folks. That's a kind of reconversion that I think that we don't understand very well.
Paul Ricoeur talks about the first naivete. You adopt your parents' traditions,
right,
and you go through these adolescence. The adolescence means you get a graduate degree. You start doubting everything, and you know all.
Right.
But by the time you grow up, you adopt the second naivete.
Right.
Whether it's at 38 or 48, you come to a realization that I've got to have faith in something. And so you come back this time as an adult and either adopt your home, your earlier faith, or some other worldview.
Right.
But yes, you know, the old idea, you know everything when you're a teenager, and you get humble when you get a little older. I think there's that issue. But Tocqueville, on this point that you bring up, is one of my favorite politically incorrect writers, because he, at the age of 26... came here, spent about 18 months, went home and wrote Democracy in America, and he said, you got to be impressed with the Anglo-Saxon culture. He's a Frenchman, remember, a Norman, you know. Not a Mormon, a Norman. You know, they're going to be fantastically successful in the United States. They'll be the greatest country in the world in terms of power. That they have two deep moral flaws. First of all, they're going to obliterate the native population, and they are going to permanently enslave the African population. He said the problem with Anglo-Saxon is, quote, they have a distaste for marrying people of color. Therefore, unlike other classical forms of slavery, where when the slave was freed, he would assimilate into the society and become a full citizen, in an Anglo-Saxon society, a person of color who's enslaved can be liberated, except never assimilated. And therefore, he saw the problems. And I'm not speaking politically here on one axis or other on this thing, but he saw brilliantly, I think, the problem that these kids were having in a Mormon culture, where they said, you're Mormons, you're fine, you're wonderful kids. And then all of a sudden, oh, I don't know if I want to date them, because I don't know if I want to marry them. Why? Well, you don't want to say it, but the color matters. I, at the University of Chicago, was friends with many black students. And when I'd get into their community in depth, they'd say, you don't know the dirty little secret? Color matters. To us, too. We have clubs in New York where you go if you want a girl of a certain color. You know you're going to go there. It's off. You know, if you look at India today, and you see the studies now today, even though they're trying to get away from the caste system, the taste for color matters. Cosmetic surgery there is very much a matter of skin color. So I think when you say the elephant in the room is finally in the room, and you can say these are a matter of deep cultural taste, I think then we can start thinking about things in different ways and why there's such deep resentment over something that seems so idiotic as to the color of skin. It makes so much difference in the way we relate with each other. And so I just wanted to bring that out here. That's another factor, that even though they're brought in to change their identities and change their cultures, their bodies do matter. Our bodies matter.
I just want to add the Swedish sociologist Dahl, The American Dilemma. He's a Swedish sociologist that, like Tocqueville, came over studying America, and he said the American Dilemma is that color that he didn't put it in Anglo-Saxon, but that there is this tension, and that this is going to be an American problem for a long, long time.
And we're finding it's a world problem, too. That's why it's interesting. It's an anthropological problem. Yes.
No, and I think, though, that it is changing as you go around the world. I think it's that what you were saying. Many people will say, I want my children to look like me. It's that same idea of what you're saying, not wanting to marry someone of another color. And it's changing. You go, we have children in Palo Alto. There are so many Asian American couples there. You see it all over. You know, you walk around now and you see black and white couples. You're seeing more and more of it, and I think we will continue to. And I think of what you were talking about, this global perspective, that we do have to get along and get together because we are continually doing it. So when you see these areas where so many people have come together, you see a change. We have friends from Norway who are coming here for a year with their young children, 3 and 6, just so their children can learn English before they go back to Norway. We see our granddaughter learning Spanish from a Spanish friend in their home because they want her to be bilingual. So it's happening.
Using your paper as a comment, though, it's bilinguality that's happening. The issue here seemed to be, don't learn your native language. Forget it. And so,
but they don't forget it. The young children learn languages very quickly. I'm not saying that the program is good. I think that taking out of the families was a difficult thing. But we're always saying, oh, the Americans, they don't know enough languages. They should be learning more languages. We should be understanding more cultures. So I don't think a young child forgets the other language. They need to concentrate more on one. But then it's the not being with that culture that they would eventually lose it. But they were going back in the summer and using their language.
Yes, but some of the students did actually forget their languages, according to one of the anthropologists that I looked at. Also, I mean, if you're spending the majority of your year not speaking a language and you don't have very many people to whom you could speak that language, you're going to forget it. I mean, children are good at picking up languages, but if they don't get to practice it, they're not going to remember it. And this also is the state that passed a proposition a few years ago where we don't really allow English as a second language education anymore. We're supposed to immerse children into English and not encourage them to continue to speak other languages in school.
In terms of the French missionary program, yeah, how did language affect that situation there? Did they teach French? Did they go with the indigenous languages and assume that the missionary language was going to be the indigenous language?
They learned the indigenous languages. I mean, the French missionaries were proficient linguists. I mean, they really founded what has become a tradition of American linguistics. Even to the point of understanding that certain characteristic worldview assumptions are rooted in language. I mean, they knew, for example, that what we have always seen as Native American indigenous superstition as attributing life and vitality and intentionality to plants and animals and even inanimate objects. The Jesuits knew this by 1633 because they knew the language, and they put it that Native Americans attributed souls, the existence of souls, to not only blueberry bushes, but also to canoes and moccasins and toboggans, and they got it. I mean, they got it because they learned the linguistic principle.
Did they find...
language isn't neutral.
Did they find that language... going along with your thesis, if I can think about what you said to begin with, was it impossible to be a good Roman Catholic Frenchman and an indigenous American Indian? And in the Jesuits' mind, did you have to do one or the other? Was it syncretism? Was it a bad thing? Or did they say, no, you could be a Catholic and an Indian?
Well, they fostered a conversation. I mean, that's why I would argue that the study of missionization really has to be a study of dialogue, the character of a conversation. And of course, French people brought notions of gender and class and race to some extent to any conversation they were having, which complicated the thing because Native Americans were doing that. But in a very significant degree, the Jesuits understood Native American culture that we're just catching up with at the beginning of the century. So they knew, for example, that Native Americans were not theists. And paradoxically, they could recognize that the Native American folks that they knew were also ethical. So there was an ethics, a relational ethics in place that they had no choice but to admire. And so they attempted not to translate from the intellectual tradition of French Catholicism, but rather in relationship to the folks and the sensibilities that they were meeting. So they never taught theism as a principle. Instead, they invented a neologism and referred to their God as he who made all, without displacing the basic insight, you know, that all has a similar ontology because everything has intelligence, will, voice, desire, need, interdependence. So they just gave a new language that centralized the Algonquian world without making it theologically different. At least that's my argument.
Did they
for that situation?
Did they attempt to intermarry? That would be a good thing? Did they have some social idea that the ultimate goal would be to have European Indians intermarry?
Absolutely. The French state, of course, I mean, French colonization was on a very, very small scale. I mean, by 1660, there were maybe 30,000 Frenchmen in what is now Canada. And so the French state recognized that the colony of New France would not succeed against the colony of New England without a significant population base. And so they saw intermarriage as being the desirable way to achieve that assimilation and culture change that, you know, the federal government obviously, and very much of what you document, is coercive in nature. The French experiment was not coercive.
Except if intermarriage is adult genocide. In other words, cultural genocide. Even though you're not taking children away, you're creating new children that are mixed, and so you're diluting the culture. This is the problem right now among Orthodox Jews in America, for example. They see the intermarriage is a horrible possibility because eventually we're going to have these Protestant Jews.
I think in the colonial period that Native American cultures were more attractive to Europeans than vice versa. James Axtell has a very, very famous essay called The White Indians of Colonial America, and about how thousands of people captured in the colonial wars were integrated in Indian society by being integrated into families. And that level of intimacy and affection, which simply was not available in the paternalistic societies of both France and England, were so attractive to these people, both Anglo and French, that they literally did not want to return to their own societies.
That's a little bit of a critique of Tocqueville there.
I'll have
to see that.
Yeah. Fascinating
yes.
stuff.
And thank you for your time. And
So it ended, from your point of view, for many reasons, top, bottom, and in the middle. Everybody eventually wanted it to end.
It should have ended a long time before. And during that period, the church was beginning to ask the question, is this really working? Because there was a second generation of placement students going to Utah. And the idea was originally that we'll take these Indian kids, we'll take them to Utah, turn them into good Mormons, and provide them a reservation. And then they will carry on the Mormon effort from there. And the second generation of kids are going up to Utah being just as Navajo as their parents were. And what worked?
You need to talk with Megan so she can document your experience. That's really important.
Yes, we have this lady here.
The Navajo people that I was acquainted with had understood it much more clearly by just one thing. They didn't call it placement. They called it what it was, replacement.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
I know in the Navajo example, because of this, the non-dogmatic base that all of this is rest on, that Navajos are religious pluralists. So, I mean, I've talked with Presbyterian missionaries who scratch their head and wondering what's going on with their program of missionization, because they know that Navajo people, they're willing to come to service on Sunday, but they also might attend Mass at St. Michael's Mission, a Catholic situation, go to a Blessing Way ceremony on Wednesday, and a Native American church service on Saturday night. Navajos commonly do this. But on the other hand, the Native American church, which uses peyote, created a lot of official hostility on the part of the Navajo government. I'm just wondering if, I don't know, what was the attitude of the Navajo government towards the LDS Church and those programs. Do you know?
Well, I wasn't involved with any government.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You had a comment or a question.
Yes. I just want to preface this with that I am young and naive, but I was wondering about why did they go directly to the source? Was there any way that they could have just given economic help? Because I know the church is famous for giving, you know, economic help where it is needed. And my second question is, was there research done before they started implementing this program? And was there any sort of checks and balances during, like, were they checking up on how it was working? Why, if it was such a disaster, why wasn't it ended sooner? And just what are your thoughts on all that?
For your first question, I don't know. I know that Kimball was talking about the problems on, I believe, in particularly the Navajo Reservation as early as the 1940s. So there was awareness that there were economic problems on indigenous reservations. But I don't know why they didn't try to help economically in addition to the program or in place of the program. The program itself started unofficially in 1947 when Helen John, a Navajo girl, who was working with her migrant family as they, did agricultural work for different places. She asked one white woman she could live in their backyard and go to school rather than continue on with her migrant family to the next place where she would have to do work. And the family let her stay and eventually let her come into the house and stay there. And the success with her eventually led to the program actually being founded 7 years later. The Mormon Church also had a lot of social workers who, I believe there were Mormon social workers, who would check up on the families and the children. So I assume that they were aware of the problems that were
sure.
going on.
I mean, there was a self-policing issue always to try to avoid abuse or anything like that. I mean, there was an administration of the program. But the goals of the program were varied. Depending on who you talk to, from both the parents involved on both sides to the students, so that was one of the problems. But also, we did hear some of the evidence is the program was not a total failure. In other words, by some of the participants, they said they were glad for the program. They saw the ambivalence and all the problems, but they were glad, some of them were glad that they participated in the program. So it's a very interesting problem we have here to try to give an assessment of the whole thing. I would like, yes, there's a comment in the back.
Yes, Oh, yeah. I've got two questions related to that. One is, you mentioned the BYU did a study in the 90s of participants in the program who were still active.
Right.
Were those participants, were any of them in church leadership positions on the reservation?
I know that one was, I believe that there was a bishop, and there might have been a branch president, too. So some of them did have priesthood positions. I'm not sure that the interviews always identify whether they had positions, though.
And that very response, the idea that a successful program or happy, you have to have a position in the church in order to show, that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
Okay, a successful program means I might have enjoyed learning about the culture and have a broader worldview. It might have meant that I'm making more money now because I'm working in L.A. at a good job and my brother isn't. You know, it's tough to say what they would.
It does say something about our idea of what success would be for the program.
Right. If the Latter-day Saint said it's a hierarchical position and an active member of the church, that would be a criteria for success. That's true.
Well, my second question is that, the church, if you look at, say, BYU Hawaii right now, you know, the objectives of that bringing students from the Pacific Islands and from East Asia, you know, their objectives are to give them a solid foundation for leadership, for business, for skills, and then to send them back to their respective, you know, communities to be successful, whether in, you know, business or the church or whatever. And I just wonder if the placement program's objectives were along those same lines, you know, we want to give them skills, we want to assimilate them more or make them more familiar with, you know, the Caucasian kind of Mormon society, and maybe teach them better Mormonism, like you said earlier, and then to send them back. You know, that was the program's objectives. And then, but you said most of the parents' objectives were more economic or educational. And so it seems like a lot of the conflict here might just have stemmed from the church's objectives, and the parents' motivation for sending their kids were probably different. And I just wonder if there's a correlation between families that sent their children because they want, families who sent their children with the motivation that's more similar to the church's. We want to send our children so that they learn more about the church. They learn more, you know, less economic education, more about more kids. For those families, what's the greater correlation between the families who sent their children for the purposes that were similar with the churches? Did they feel more, you know, did they feel that the program was successful?
Well, a number of the people interviewed by BYU who, you know, fit the idea of, you know, what a successful student from this program would be, were sent on the program because their parents couldn't afford to take care of them, or they thought this would be a better thing for them. So the parents' wishes didn't match with what the church necessarily wanted, but these students still came out okay. So I don't know if there's necessarily a correlation with that.
Yes.
I don't find the language issue was a big deal later on, because the language had already been lost. They weren't speaking Navajo. They weren't learning Navajo. I mean, we did a study at the University of Arizona about 10 years ago, and we found that only maybe 10% of the people still knew Navajo or had a good knowledge of comprehending or speaking it. And my experience at the junior high on the reservation is very few of the kids knew Navajo.
Really?
Recently.
Today?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't know about isolated communities. I knew about those that report defiance. So, you know.
Right, this would depend.
I just kind of add on to that, because I'm a professor at Northern Arizona University in the sociology department. I work with the Navajo tribe in terms of revitalization of the language. And that is one of their top priorities. But within the last 5 to 8 years, there has been a resurgence in terms of the language, and they see that they need to seek the Navajo language early in both the Hopi, but in fact, I think that's universal in terms of tribes. But they're really putting a lot of money and attention to kind of reseed that, so there is a in terms of the language. And I just wanted to So they see it as critical to keep that language.
Yeah. I think that's great, but how many at the time the program ended actually understood and knew the language?
I go through my days at the Utah State International School. It's interesting that the kids amalgamated the language. I mean, they began to use English idioms with things, not Spanish, but Navajo phrases, so that there was a composite language, I guess, of adolescents or of certain individuals, and that linguists kind of study that. But there is a blending, and all of the kids that I interviewed had some degree of familiarity. They didn't have what you call total competency, many of them, but they could communicate within their peer group very effectively.
Well, these language issues also depend on the particular nation that we're talking about and the generation that we're talking about. The program lasted from 1954 to 1992. And, I mean, even if we want to just talk about the Navajo generation of the 1950s is not the Navajo generation of the 1980s and 1990s. I don't know who you were studying in particular.
Well, we were looking at Native languages throughout the state. You know, I'm trying to revitalize them, trying to give them a little bit of help. And, you know, what we found was that, you know, they were disappearing. We were very alarmed. And we noticed they had a program at this particular junior high that failed. You know, it didn't continue on. And with all of the television and the media and stuff, it overrode anything that they were trying to do. It was very sad.
And to ask this question, I'd like to, you know, move to a little broader. Why is it sad? Are we nostalgic about it?
Well,
I'm probing your values here. Why is it sad?
I would say it was sad because as I watched what had happened with the gangs on the reservation, the graffiti on the reservation, the role models the kids chose, you know, the loss of their culture, the good things, it was gone. You know, they don't idolize anything Navajo, basically. The ones that I saw in the particular junior high school, my life very sad.
Is it tragically sad in that it's inevitable, it's going to happen, there's nothing we can do about it except put the languages in history museums like other archaic languages that are there that we no longer use? Or do you want to actually try to create a worldview where we're bilingual, that somehow we're two people? We watch TV, we have great English accents, but we also have wonderful linguistic ability in our native tongue, and we can continue to have our old cultures and maintain old cultural traditions. Is this something you see as what the world ought to be?
I would like to see them retain their culture and take the best of what we have to offer. What I saw was increasing drug use and, you know, knifings, killings, spread of AIDS in particular, a complete breakdown of the culture that used to be.
Is that specific to the Navajo, though?
I agree with it. Because we've done some studies on the reservation in terms of delinquency and drug use and what we call marginality. And the marginality is a sociology theory, but I think it has applicability, but that we did a fairly good job of correlating the less they know about their language, their traditional religion, their sense of community, and it's really kind of breaking down their sense of community. Community means social control, and when that's broken, they're not assimilated into the broader mainstream culture. They're kind of in this time warp, and that is in that time warp or that marginalization that is absolutely destructive. And it's really more powerful in terms of the males, the young male Native Americans. But that's where the delinquency, drugs, is really critical. So I think this is where I'm kind of sad, in the sense that we do a good job of breaking community down, but we don't have a very good job of reformulating community.
We don't know how to do that.
Particularly in terms of that reservation, all the negative of the Western culture
seems to kind of overpower, but we don't tend to kind of bring a community in or that sense of social control. So I think it's a very critical issue.
I think, join us here on the panel. If you're on Mars looking at the Earth, you might say the same thing about the issues that are going on in Western culture. Mm-hmm. Family values versus the very pluralism of the world we're in, we tend to be losing the sense of an unchallenged environment where we're safe. Everything is up for grabs and question. And therefore, in a broader sense, about the microcosm of a Navajo culture, but what's happening, I would say, worldwide,
it's
a macro thing happening. We have drugs happening a lot of places that aren't on the Navajo reservation.
Yeah, this isn't unique to them.
Yeah, and my friends, I work with Muslims, and their big question is, how, as the ambassador from Iran told me a few months ago, how can I get my kids to graduate from Harvard and keep the faith? How can we adopt the good medicine, to use English, the good medicine of the West, literally, good scientific medicine, and chuck the philosophy? How do we keep the tradition but have nice cars? You know, that's going on all over the world today. You were going to make a comment.
Well, this whole issue of language, whether it's sad or not, I of course it is. I mean, it's tragic. But I made this statement earlier, and I really mean seriously, that language is not neutral. Language encapsulates particular ways of thinking and being and knowing and valuing that. And when we lose a human language, we've lost something of human heritage that we don't know because of our own language system. I mean, manifestly, English is a language of nouns, which has produced the kind of objective-subjective dichotomy in which we all live. Navajo is a language of verbs. And so they're not concerned conceptually and behaviorally and ethically with interaction with a world constituted by objects, but rather the world constituted as being. You know, I mean, think about this. Navajos can distinguish 230,000 ways to go. Now, if you want to think about physics based on an understanding of process, I would put it out there that Navajo is the language to do this in. We lose Navajo, we've really lost a human capacity to think in a very particular way. And I think that we don't know that because I think that the old doctrine of primitivism is still very much alive and well, and we think that our understanding that language, that a system of words is symbolic for an existent reality outside there, is true for all people. But it's not true for the Navajo. I mean, Gary Witherspoon in Language and Art in the Navajo Universe has argued that Navajos understand human beings vitally connected with the being of the world in language acts. So Navajos have a sense of ethical responsibility that we can't even imagine. I mean, Native Americans always encapsulate their view of ethics by saying we have to be respectful. And that seems like a nice attitude, but it's far more than that because the world is dangerous and human beings in the world are dangerous. You lose the language then. What I'm saying is you lose worldview. You lose insight about a human capacity. And in the Navajo case, it has to do with understanding of creativity. It has to an understanding of responsibility. It has to do with an understanding of human being in relationship to the world. Well, in Bo's session this morning, it was like Native Americans are not theists, so they're not organized religiously on those principles. But they are profoundly religious in a way that is completely startling.
We're talking about what we would like them to do. What is a baby in a Navajo family now? What language are they learning?
It's going to depend on the family and whether that family.
Do we know what's going on with them? What are they doing with them?
Well, I assume they're aware of the problem that they're dealing with, it, however they feel is best.
You realize that linguists can document that we are losing human language several times every day. I mean, by the end of this century, the intellectual poverty that we're facing from the loss of these languages, and I don't just mean flavor and sensibility, I mean distinctions, important distinctions about what it means to be a being and what it means to be ethical. I mean, we're going to lose these insights. And I think it's not sad, it's tragic, and it has consequences for us all. I would argue that the study of religion has got to be comparative, because we don't know the particular box that we live, think, and be in. And the only way to do that is to see whether there's an alternative out there. And I insist that Native Americans live in genuine realities that are genuinely alternative to our own. Which means that the study of religion is really learning from other people how to think.
And which is ironic to this whole enterprise that we've had here today. Because we're saying, on the one hand, to know your own religion, you've got to get out there. But when you get out there, you find there are alternative orders than yours.
Right.
You learn those languages, and it creates a doubt on the superiority or what you were taught when you were growing up as the onlyness of the,
right,
of the world.
Right.
And that very critique tends to your strength of conviction in your worldview as being the safe one. And so we have this liminal space that we throw ourselves into. Both in to get the self-knowledge, you have to have something outside yourself. On the other hand, that creates self-doubt. And so we have the world that we're in today with this very powerful understanding that, as we studied, I studied missionaries as part of my dissertation who'd go to China. These were happening Presbyterians. They'd go to China and spend their life there, come back home. They were converted to Chinese ways. They couldn't stand their they thought they had such small-minded congregations back in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
That they hated them when they came home from Cleveland, from
right,
China, because they were critiquing them. So what changed? There are not that many Presbyterians in China. But darn it, those missionaries came home changed.
Yeah.
They came home radically changed.
We call it reverse missionary.
And so, again, we have the irony of the proselytizer being the one who's converted, not necessarily to a new religion, but to a different view, and a view that isn't as whatever it was, as orthodox in the way the prior one was orthodox. And so, again, I'd like to leave with this thought. Not leave, we've still got to continue this, but the idea of the impossibility, the tragedy, meaning it's unavoidable, the tragedy of loss when something else is gained. William James's idea that we can't have it both ways. We have to make decisions in a world where there are only so many languages that could be grasped. Which ones are going to win? And how we get involved in the influence of the ones that will win, or preserving as many as we can, and how we persuade others to do it without it becomes a power game. It becomes a game that's so tied to politics and money, and who has the airwaves, who has the voice, who's on the panel, and who's in the audience. And those things we need to very carefully think about.
I've heard the English language is a language of material things, and so if the language focuses on it's great for capitalism. The same
no, it is, and science. And no, absolutely. If you don't know the work, everyone should read George Lakoff and Mark Johnson's incredibly important study, Metaphors We Live By. I mean, because we tend to think that metaphors are a literary device, and their argument is not at all. It is a language is a conceptual device. I mean, our idea that a concept is a container, it's an idea is something that holds something inside it, so you unpack it. So the reality is, you know, out there, and we got to get at it. I mean, the language consciousness is metaphoric in nature, and we don't know this. You know, if I could start all over, I would become a sociolinguist.
Let me ask this question to go it back: Is the Navajo language is the Navajo culture, in a pragmatic sense, you said they're pragmatic.
Right.
With the notion of somehow the size of influence being the goal, I don't know what the notion is to determine the success. Is it a failed culture? Is it a failed language in the sense of some criteria that could be agreed upon by Navajos? In other words, should the Navajos be a billion people today because their language has a superior way of influencing people, or are we seeing the results of this language's inability to influence only maybe the cognitive, or as you said, maybe the abstract physicist today needs to know Navajo, but those eggheads, you know, they don't have any power in the world.
Native American peoples from beginning to present have looked at non-Indian cultures of various European stripes and colors and have always located us in a box in which they locate monsters. and by that they mean, you know, the antisocial and what we would call witchcraft and viciousness. You know, the Navajo stereotype of non-Indian cultures, and you can read Tony Hillerman in his novels and you'll see it show up. I mean, it's all over the place. They say of us, they act as though they have no relatives. Because we're individualists, right? We're self-oriented. I mean, we basically don't have a family structure that even holds a few people together, let alone extended groups of people in terms of the clan understanding of Navajo life.
The way they introduce themselves, they introduce themselves in terms of a clan. They don't say, I'm a professor.
That's right.
They introduce their own, you know.
And there's not an assumption. I mean, for us, talk is cheap, right? I mean, we'll talk to each other fairly intimately, fairly quickly. Navajos know that talk is dangerous. I mean, I literally worked with a Navajo scholar on issues of oral tradition for 2 years before she offered her hand. And I was completely shocked. I mean, I knew that the entire conversation had then been validated in a way that I had no certainty before. That was a big deal.
To pick up your point, though, and to press my question, are we saying, I think, is it George Churchill, he's a Navajo social critic. His big criticism is the West, as he would say, or the rest of us, are so oriented linguistically, culturally, toward growth.
Right.
Toward having more.
Right.
Progress. More children. Progress. He actually says more children. To fill a space is success. For him, that's wrong. That's the problem. Is the very idea of growth is so overwhelmingly powerful to any other idea of kind of mutually getting along in a small way without overpowering. Just
right.
Keeping yourself in a small... That concept of the West, he says, we're going to lose. We are losing because we just can't compete with that notion. He's saying it's unethical, it's genocide, the very notion of growth.
It has to do with how we understand causality. Initially, when I looked at the program notes, I came up with some things about the language that we're engaging in this panel, cultures in collision, for example. Look at how mechanical that is. I mean, we're people, we're folks. You know, we have faces, and that's the essential part of our nature. But when we in anthropology and sociology and religious studies reify all of that and now start talking about Native American culture and Mormon culture or any other kind of culture that collide, we're moving it into a mechanical place. That is a function of language. English wants to talk about what causes. Native American languages are not interested in that question. They're rigorously concerned with who causes. And we don't know how to think about the who-ness of the world any longer. And on that basis, you know, the work that I'm doing is looking at the foundations of the American anthropological tradition to demonstrate that this whole tradition of objectivity as a way of knowing is precisely the kind of intellectual colonialism that we haven't recognized and that we're still exercising precisely because of our languages and, well, and the prestige of the natural sciences in relationship to the social sciences. I'm in religious studies because we need a new interpretive model. And I think that I'm learning something about how to do that in terms of Native American peoples.
Megan, you have the last say today.
Oh, okay. Well, I would like to respond to the comments about language. And, I mean, I think I would rather have the Navajo people be able to speak Navajo. I think more is better.